Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I begin in the name of the God whose mercy is profound, whose kindness is forever. In this particular session, I am going to present before you the counter-narrative. There's a lot of talk about counter-narrative in Pakistan, probably in other countries as well. Why? Because, you know what? People don't normally read the Quran and Hadith directly. A, because probably it's difficult, it's more of a scholarly endeavor. And B, because common man is probably wants ease. Presentations that just, you know, are made in a manner that they are able to absorb and they don't have to go into any kind of debate, academic debate. The understanding of religion that becomes popular amongst a group of people is comprised of a number of ideas. Obviously, the claim of the one who is presenting is that these ideas are firmly entrenched, rooted in the original sources of the Quran, Sunnah and Hadith. But it is those ideas that really influence, inspire, and motivate people. Those ideas put together is what is called narrative. Right now, it is the extremist, radical, jihadi narrative which is popular. You mention it, and people would say, that's it, got it. You know, like, we talked about the fact that the companions, they fought against the enemy and they subjugated. That's what is taken in as a religious reality, unquestioned. Now, if we want that the understanding of Islam that we think, I think, should become popular, I think is right, should become popular, I ought to come up with a narrative which is describing my religion, at least in this particular area, which is bothering us right now. A description of my religious understanding, which on the one hand is authentic, it can be shown to be emerging from the original sources, and on the other is understandable. So, that narrative would challenge the already existing narrative, and we let people decide as to which of the two is making more sense and is giving them reasons to believe that this indeed is what God is saying. Javed Ahmed Ghamdi Sahib, that's what we say in Urdu, and let me say, he's not a doctor, he's much more, but he's not a doctor. I think people, because think that a doctor is a very highly rated scholar, so Ghamdi Sahib, how is it possible that he cannot be a doctor? Well, he is a person who has been responsible for many doctors, including a very ordinary doctor like me, to become doctors. But he himself, I think right from the beginning, he realized that he better not waste his time in doing PhD. He had other more important things to do. And he undertook original research in Islam. And obviously, it's always a very likely possibility that a student or would praise and eulogize and exaggerate his teacher's abilities. But let me not do it. But I'm telling you that he is the one who has come up with a counter-narrative, which I'm sure he did because he felt the responsibility of doing it. He wrote it, 10 points of it, which I'm going to read out before you. Wrote it in Urdu, It was published as an article in the Urdu newspapers in Pakistan. They were translated. It was translated into English, and in English newspapers also it was published. And I'm sure that Fakhar Sahib, we have copies of it. They're available. I am here just briefly mentioning the 10 points that he has mentioned in his counter narrative, with a view to reminding myself and you that this is what, according to one scholar, the real understanding of religion in the difficult, critical areas where we are, some of us are confused, others are bothered, and still others are very confident that the other view is correct, which is creating difficulty in this world. So I'll just mention the various points that he has raised. The 10 points that he raises, the first of them is that he says, Islam's message is for the individual and individual alone. It is the individual, the man, the woman who is living in this world, who has been addressed in the Quran. The individual has been asked to purify his, her soul, for him, her, to become eligible to enter the paradise, the beautiful eternal life of paradise. The individual is a member of a society. The individual is a member of a family. The individual is a father. The individual is a mother. The individual is a son, daughter. The individual can be a prime minister. The individual can be a minister, and many other possibilities. No matter whatever status role they play, God is addressing them, but in the capacity of an individual. God's religion is meant for humans. The point he has mentioned as a conclusion is that it is an absurdity to say that a state has a religion. A state is comprised of individuals. Individuals have religion. So that if Pakistan has, by a vast majority, people living in its land, Muslims, well, they are Muslims individually. When they will together form a system of government, of governance, quite obviously, if they are true to their religion and they are all agreed, they are all in agreement on a certain point of Islam, they will do it. But to declare that Pakistan is an Islamic state, he says, is to say that Islam also addresses a state, which he says it doesn't. And he says that what problem it causes is that when you say that Islam is an Pakistan is an Islamic state, you, by the same statement, you are declaring that, well, A, non-Muslims, you better go. And you are here in Pakistan. This country is primarily not meant for you. So you are second-rate citizens. If you want to stay with that kind of an ignominy, you know, attached to you, you're most welcome. But otherwise, it's not meant for you. He says, this is not what Islam stands for. Islam is addressing the individual, and it is the individual who is accountable to the Almighty. The second point that he mentions is that Islam is not interested in that there should be one and only one Islamic state, which should be called a Khilafah. Something which, by the way, these jihadis quite often mention. That, look here, we are divided into 57 or whatever number of states. It's a tragedy. We are broken into different parts. But what he says is that it is none of the requirements of Islam that there should be one Islamic state called Khilafat. He says the word Khilafat is not even a religious expression. It is an it is an Arabic word. It really means that somebody coming after another. And that's it. Muslims in the very first century had two states. One in Spain, the other had the capital in Baghdad. And the very great jurists whom we all respect, none of them raised any objection that here's something seriously un-Islamic happening. He says that it really is a cry, a slogan raised by some intellectuals and poets of the 20th century that let's bring back the glory of the real Islam and let's make one Islamic state. He says that that is not what the requirement of Islam is. The point number three that he mentions is Muslims, according to the Quran, are brothers of each other and sisters. إِنَّمَا الْمُؤْمِنُونَ إِخْوَةٌ. They are a fraternity, and that's it. It really means that you are living in Australia, I am living in Pakistan, we are still brothers. We'll say prayers together. If you are, God forbid, in some trouble, I should make an attempt to come to your rescue if possible. We should have a good, strong feeling with each other. It doesn't necessarily follow that we should all be nationals of the same country. That is not what the Quran has mentioned anywhere. The only relationship that it has mentioned that one believer has with another is a relationship of a fraternity of belonging to the same brotherhood. And when that is true, well, that's what we should be doing. Muslims can be living in a country where they are in a majority. Muslims can be living in a country where they are in a minority. You know, if you are in the majority, you have to behave as a good Muslims. If you are living in a country where you are in a minority, behave as good Muslims, which obviously includes be good humans as well. The fourth point he mentions is that scholars have a right to correct the wrongs that are happening in a society. It is their duty. They are the ones who have to let people know what Islam is talking about. That is what they must do. But no scholar, no state has any right or authority to declare anyone a non-Muslim. A person who himself says, I am a Muslim. You think he has gone absolutely wrong. Well, correct him. That's what the duty of the scholars is. Tell them what the truth is. Correct their point of view. Give arguments. But there is no reason why anyone should go beyond that. Everybody has a right to choose to be labeled as what he or she wants to be described as, quite obviously. There are some people who, despite being Muslims, are believing in and doing things which are very distanced from the ideals of Islam. Well, they need to be corrected properly, politely, intelligently. But there is no reason why people should be broken into different groups and people should be shunted out from the group, big group called Islam, because some people think that others have beliefs which are absolutely wrong. The fifth point is that he says that polytheism, shirk, disbelief, non-belief or rejection of belief, kufr, and irtidad, apostasy. That is somebody who becomes a non-Muslim, declares that he is a non-Muslim after he was a Muslim. These are serious problems, but only punishable by God. Nobody else can punish them. No individual, no state has the right and authority to punish a person who is committing shirk. They can do things to convince them, to remove the possibilities of doing shirk or kufr or irtidad, apostasy, but nobody has a right to inflict any punishment as an individual or as a society, which is only the prerogative of God Almighty. And God is going to punish those people who are going to commit these evils on the day of judgment. And he did punish people in this world as well through his messenger. When shirk was mushrik, polytheists were punished by being killed. Likewise, those who rejected the truth, as I mentioned earlier, were punished by being reduced to either being second-rate citizens or by being killed. And those who, after having declared themselves Muslims, again went back and declared that they were non-Muslims, because they belonged to the same era, they were also killed for the same reason. This was God's punishment. God sometimes punishes people through some other people. When those some other people become his tools of implementing his punishment, when they are in direct contact with God through his revelation. Like, for example, Ibrahim alayhis salam, Abraham, was about to slaughter his child, his son, Ismail. You and I can't do it. We can't claim that, you know, we also had a dream. And like the great Abraham, we are following his sunnah. Nobody can say that. It would be absolute rubbish. So, this is something which was exclusively possibility of when there was direct revelation being revealed. Likewise, the famous story of the person who is normally described as Khizr alayhis salam, he killed a child while he was playing, and then mentioned that this child was likely to be troublemaker, problematic for his parents. You and I can't do it. We are not in direct contact with God. So he says that the killing of polytheists, the killing of unbelievers, the killing of apostates was likewise done by God. And let's not confuse it with Sharia law. It is not Sharia. It was God's intervention, direct intervention. And for God's sake, don't confuse God's religion with the incidents which are very clearly only God's domain, which he implemented only when his messengers were there or somebody who was directly in contact with God. In case of Khizr's killing of the child, the understanding which makes more sense is, although there's a debate as to whether he was a messenger, prophet, or an angel, that it was like any ordinary death. You know, God, you and I can't kill. You know, I've said it over and over again. I mean, if you and I can kill, then what about the Quran, which says that you cannot kill? On the other hand, God kills every day. He gives life. He takes away life. So it's his right, his prerogative. So he asked his angel to kill a child. So it wasn't something that was meant for anybody else to emulate. Then he says, point number 6, that jihad is to be undertaken by the state, the ruler and ruler alone. And can only be undertaken against oppression. And it has got nothing to do with individuals or group of people who do not have any right or authority to run the affairs of a state. Point number 7 that he makes is that jihad is for God. That is, jihad is fi sabilillah, in the way of God. Therefore, even if it's war, it's a battle, it still must be undertaken within the parameters, constraints of moral principles. You cannot go beyond the limits of moral principles. The Almighty says in the Quran that you fight against them who fight with you, wala ta'tadu, and don't go beyond limits. This is verse 192 of Surah Al-Baqarah. That is, you cannot violate moral principles. If somebody is fighting you, you fight against them, but you certainly cannot go beyond the limits of morality. Therefore, the Prophet, may God's mercy be on him, clarified and required his followers to only fight if fighting was needed, and I've already mentioned why it was needed. The combatants, those who come face to face to fight. Under no circumstances, non-combatants can be killed. Women, children, etc. cannot be killed. Likewise, if somebody is using his or her tongue against you, your religion, well, use your tongue to correct the evil, to let the person know that what he or she is saying is wrong. Using tongue cannot be retaliated for by the person being killed. You see, it's an exaggerated response. So if some people are fighting and you're fighting with them, well, okay, you're fighting for the purpose of eliminating oppression, or maybe somebody has come to kill you and you are defending yourselves. But if somebody is using his tongue and in an evil way, in response, what you can do is that use your tongue. But you cannot go beyond moral limits. Your response cannot be exaggerated. Likewise, if somebody is using his funds to help those people who are fighting against Muslims, then stop them from using those funds. You can't kill them, because that again is something which is going to be against what the Quran says, what the Hadith says, wala ta'tadu. Don't go beyond limits. Don't exaggerate. War is to be undertaken sometimes because it's unavoidable, but that too has to be within the constraints of morality. Then he goes on to say that point number 8 of his narrative, that Islam, long time before this world was introduced to the idea of democracy, mentioned Amruhum Shura Bainahum. Believers in their collective matters, their decision is based on mutual consultation. And therefore, believers, whenever there is a matter that has to do with collectivity, it has to be based on mutual consultation. Whether it takes the form of democracy or whether it takes any other form of consultation, it has to be consultation based. Which really means that if there is a society where one person is ruling over all others and is using his dictatorial powers to implement what he thinks is right, whether you call him by the expression Amirul Mu'mineen, whether the person is extremely pious and God-fearing, what he is doing is completely un-Islamic. Because the rule is that Muslims, when they live in this world as a group, as a collectivity, they form a system, and the system can take different forms. There is no binding system that the Quran has or Hadith has laid out. However, one principle has been made binding on the system, which is that it has to be consultation-based. And consultation-based means that if there are people who are chosen to be a part of the consultative, whatever, shura, they all agree unanimously, and that's how the decision is going to be. That's how the law is going to be. But if they disagree, then the majority decision is going to prevail. Number 9, he says that an Islamic state, a state which claims to be following the law of the Almighty, has to protect the lives, the honor, the property of the common citizens. It will use the public assets for the purpose of the welfare of the poor. It will make sure that the Jummah prayer is conducted under the auspices and authority of the ruler, so that there are no sects emerging. The Eid prayer is to be conducted. The Islamic ruler is going to arrange for a force, call it police force or whatever, which is going to encourage virtue and is going to discourage vice, which doesn't really mean that they are going to implement the juristic opinions of some individuals. What is evil is well known to everybody, all humans, and what is vice is also known. So they'll do Amr bil Maruf, Nahi anil Munkar. However, what he says in this point is that positive expectation from an individual to follow Islamic rules is only in two areas where the ruler can force the citizens to follow, which is saying prayers and giving zakat. This is what the Quran says twice, that if these people, they repent and say their prayers and give zakat, don't touch them. Leave them aside. They are your brothers. He says that a ruler can urge its citizens, his citizens, to fast. He cannot force them. He can urge people who have resources to do hajj, but he cannot force them. Likewise, in other areas. Everything else that is to be positively followed is to be promoted through preaching, through teaching, through encouraging in different ways. But there are only two things that are positively, if a ruler wants to do, he can do it, which is saying prayers and paying zakat. And finally, he says that if a Muslim ruler fails in his duties to conduct the affairs of the society in an Islamically acceptable, desirable way, then scholars' duty is to correct him, to urge him to not do what he is doing, that is, not go for the evil way. The scholars should guide him. The scholars should warn him. That's what their duty is. What he's trying to say is that in no way, scholars or anybody else can revolt against the ruler by undertaking an effort, and a collective effort, which would cause bloodshed. This is just not allowed. They are living in a society where things are not going in the right manner. Scholars, and if there are people who are following the opinions of those scholars, they should do as best as they can to encourage, warn the rulers that they should follow the right Islamic way and should desist from the evil ways that they have adopted. This was, as I said, the narrative that was written by him and published in different papers, journals, etc. Obviously, you can expect that as a consequence of it, quite a bit of debate was generated, and there were many articles written in response to this particular counter narrative of Javed Ahmed Ghamdi Sahib. Sadly, most of the discussion, or call it criticism, was focused on his very first point, which said that it's an absurdity to say that a state has a religion. Religion has got to do with the individual, and if the individual is the ruler, then religion would address him as well. It's not that a country or countries could be declared belonging to one religion or the other. Thank you.